Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. This is hour two of the show. And in this part of the program, we're happy to have with us once again David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at the U of I. He is director of the unit for cinema studies. And every once in a while here, he is stopped by and we talk about movies and generally have a good time talking about movies that we have seen. Maybe movies that we're looking forward to. We're now just on the brink of the big summer season where a lot of stuff blows up and the industry hopes that people will come in and pay money to see that stuff blow up. And some people enjoy those movies. If you don't, that's fine. If you're interested in talking about movies generally and how movies are made, that's fine. And certainly if there's a movie that you have seen recently that you just thought was particularly good, and you'd like to say, like to call in and say, here, I saw this film and I thought it was really a great movie and maybe other people would enjoy it. You can do that. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here once again.
My pleasure.
I read in a recent story about the movie biz and about the summer season that in the summer between the first weekend of May and Labor Day, 40% of the movie tickets are sold. So obviously for the big studios, for anyone who makes movies, this is a huge time. You're making a lot of money or hoping that you're going to make your money right now.
That's right.
And I know that that wasn't always that way. Did it used to be the case, if you went back far enough, that basically the ticket sales were kind of about the same year round?
It depends on how far back you want to go. Before World War II, yes, there was no particularly big thing. In the 50s and 60s, you started to see, but yeah, basically that's right. I mean, everyone points to the summer. I mean, the two things they point to is A, the blockbuster, and B, the summer blockbuster, and that's attributed to Jaws mm-hmm. In 1975. But if you go back and look at some of the real sort of epoch-changing movies, you'll see that they weren't necessarily summer films, but definitely post-Jaws and certainly by the 80s, it's the summer films. And that partly also has to do with demographics. People under 30 go to the movies more than people over 30. And if you think about...
Oh. Sorry about that. Forgot to turn his cell phone.
That's weird.
Sorry about that. When you're a really important guy.
Oh, my. No, I won't even do that. Sorry. Well, that's very embarrassing. Very embarrassing.
That's okay.
In any case, the demographics of young men and summer for people under 30 out of school, that's why.
Okay. We have a caller here. David Desser is our guest. I was, not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in a restaurant and this guy was sitting at the table behind me and his phone went off and the ringtone was the theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I thought to myself, now who else?
Yeah, yeah.
Who else do I know who would have
that's right.
Now, is that a ringtone for any particular person or would it happen to just go off?
No, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a particular person ringtone, but we shall not say what.
Okay. Well, then, let's just talk with the caller here. Line number one. The caller's in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about distribution of films. I'm a particular fan of Colin Firth and also Helen Hunt, and they just put out a new movie.
Yes.
And I have been looking in the paper here just trying to figure out when, if ever, that film will come to Champaign-Urbana. But not just that movie. I noticed that our local theaters don't always bring in the less popular movies.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you had any comments on that. Is it just because we're in the middle of the Midwest and they figure nobody out here likes Colin Firth or what?
Well, it's not that they don't like Colin Firth. Who doesn't? But no, it has to do with the buyers for the regional chains. So in Champaign-Urbana, we have the Art Theater, which will, you know, get what they think are the most popular kinds of art films. A lot of times, of course, lately, that's documentaries. And it's also what's available. So the Helen Hunt movie you're talking about, she wrote and directed and produced and stars in, I think, as I remember, is called And Then She Found Me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is one that I'm very anxious to see. It may or may – I don't know offhand when that will go wide. But what happens there is it's a combination of the distribution company thinking of how many prints do they want to release at the same time.
Okay.
Because of how popular they think it will be.
Okay.
Combined with the buyers for the multiplexes who, you know, we have the big chains around here. The buyer is you know, going to decide what he thinks will play well around here. And it's just been the case for years and years and years that multiplexes in small towns don't often get those kinds of films. So it's a combination of how, you know, what the distributor makes available, when the distributor makes it available. I would suspect And Then She Found Me is probably in no more than 500 screens. If you think about something like Iron Man or Indiana Jones, then you're talking about 3,000 screens.
Right,
so that's the difference. So it's a combination of the distributor making it available, when they make it available, and a combination of what the buyer believes. Now, the problem with And Then She Found Me is I don't think that will play at the art theater because it might be too commercial. So it may show up. You just have to sort of pay attention. We tend to get those things eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be surprised. But in the summer, it could be a problem because so many of the big movies take up 2, 3, or even 4 screens.
Right.
So that's the problem. It's mostly because of where we are.
Yeah, I figured that. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. That's strange, the idea that there would be a movie that would be in a niche that wouldn't exactly be considered to be an art film. Not really.
Yes.
But then also, but would be, so it would be too small for the multiplex and yet too big for a theater like the Art.
Yeah, there's a lot of films like that. Most of them will show up at the multiplex, but they'll be kind of quiet. You know, they'll sort of come and go. You don't know. I mean, I don't follow, you know, I have no way of knowing. I might, but I have no way of knowing offhand what the Beverly, you know, will get or what the Savoy will get. But, you know, you got to sort of follow the papers to see. But, you know, they do sometimes show up in a quiet way. And then you also have to watch out if they'll play more than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's just very tough to know what the thinking is. But, you know, when the big movies take up, you know, at the Savoy 16 or the Beverly, the Carmike at Beverly 20, you know, there's only 10 or 12 films there now. So, you know, and then movies might play for a week and then drop down to a one show a day. It's really, and there's no ad for them in the paper, so you really have to read the little boxes at the local. I mean, I think Champaign Urbana does a little bit better than some other multiplexes in the area, you know, in the broad area, but we're not Chicago.
Yeah. I was reading a piece about the coming Indiana Jones movie and about Steven Spielberg. And I know that, you know, maybe Spielberg's not going to be on a lot of people's lists of the greatest directors who ever lived. But if you make a list maybe of directors whose movies were very influential in terms of changing the way how movies were made and what kind of movies were made, this guy, you've got to say, yes, is very important. And certainly we had talked about the fact that he's credited with making the movie that started the idea, whole idea of the summer blockbuster,
right,
which was Jaws.
Right.
And but the point that this article made, it was Terrence Rafferty in writing in the New York Times, was that in fact that the first Indiana Jones movie has been very influential, and the way that action movies are made, the fact that we have a lot of action movies, has a lot to do with the fact that Steven Spielberg made that movie.
Well, it's the combination. Well, Spielberg for certain, but you also can't forget George Lucas, who created the franchise. And when George Lucas gave Spielberg, as it were, the opportunity to do Indiana Jones, Spielberg was on a downhill slide. He'd had some problems. I mean, of course, he made E.T., and Close Encounters, but he'd also had some flops. 1941 was a flop. Hook was a huge disappointment. Mm. So in the 80s, Spielberg was having some problems. So, you know, and of course, lest we forget, and no one has, but Lucas, you know, did Star Wars, which should also be credited with really two things, which was the revival of big-budget sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, we think about, if you think about big budget sci-fi, I bet you can't name that many films, and you can't name that many films that immediately preceded Star Wars. But as you think about big budget sci-fi, and of course, the whole generation of special effects. Because what Lucas is really interested in is technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, he invented Dolby, and he invented, you know, the miniatures and all this stuff that we really take for granted. I mean, he pioneered computer animations and computer, you know, not by himself, but certainly that's his thing. So if you think about the Star Wars and the Indiana Jones franchises, that's Lucas. But he is really not a very good director. I mean, he didn't direct Star Wars after the first one, and then the one, you know, and then the three prequels are really badly done.
Yes.
So he's not a director, so he knows who is a director. But Spielberg, who would be thought of as one of the great directors of all time by certain kinds of people, certainly one of the most competent directors of all time, and I think a very interesting director who takes film very seriously, you know, the same year that he did Jurassic Park, you know, he did Schindler's List. And however you think of either film, that's somebody not ordinary.
Yeah.
So yes, but Spielberg clearly is a storyteller and there. But I actually think in some ways Spielberg without Lucas is less bombastic than with Lucas. But the combination of the two is unbeatable. Mm.
So what is now the word on this on the new Indiana Jones movie? Has there been some word?
The buzz is hot.
I'm sure everybody is excited to see it.
Well, that's the most important thing is everybody's excited to see it. But they really are really. I think the question will be how big, mm-hmm. And it will be very interesting to see if it's gigantic or just massive. I'm not sure I know the difference, but
like see the headline gigantic question mark or just massive.
But you know that first the buzz is very good, and what's interesting about buzz and all that is how do people know what to make of a movie the first weekend? In other words. Something like Iron Man was absolutely huge the first weekend. I mean, just huge. Everybody likes it, but it's like even before people get to know whether they like it or not, there's the hot factor. And Iron Man really made that, and it's going to be tremendous. Whereas you would think Speed Racer by the guys who did The Matrix, bomb. Absolutely. And even that very first weekend, it's not like it did $75 million the first weekend and $2 million the second weekend. Hmm. It's that it did very little. It barely made more money, Speed Racer, than the silly, unfunny, poorly reviewed What Happens in Vegas with Ashton Kutcher. Mm-hmm. It barely made more money than that. And that is, you know, which is, you know, you could say, well, that's a good thing for What Happens in Vegas, but no. Happens in Vegas did more than it should, but Speed Racer did way less than it should. And that's just the first weekend. Yeah. Before even people saw it, they didn't want to see it.
Well, this is interesting. I have a couple callers I'll get right to. We've talked a little bit about this before, but I think it's interesting thing that there would have been a day where if you were looking for how a movie did in its first weekend, you'd have to read Variety or something like that. Well, now, in any the regular papers reporting the opening weekend gross.
Yeah.
And so
it
seems like almost anything can do well. Except Speed Racer, almost anything can do great the first weekend. Then how does it do subsequent to the first weekend?
Well, the two things that are interesting, and I think we talked about this maybe a year or two ago, and that is everybody now is part of the business, that the business of the movie business is public knowledge, whereas it used to be, did you like the movie? Now it's, how much did it gross? What's its per screen average? how many screens did it open in, et cetera. So the business side of things is almost as much a part of public discourse as is the movie any good or not. So that's a very interesting question.
Yeah. Well, all right, let's talk with some more folks here, and we'll talk with someone in Savoy. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Wonderful show. A couple of quick observations, and we'll go ahead and ring off. You were talking about... Now, this is me personally, but Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, just wonderful movies. But in my book, they are so, I don't know what the word is, maybe raw, that it's one of those movies, you know, you're drawn to it and you watch it and you enjoy it, but I have actually no interest in ever watching those movies again just because of the, oh, I don't know, the violence or whatever. I mean, it's not like you want to put in, a Jack Lemmon movie or something. It's just that not that type of movie. But the other point, I just out of curiosity, you were talking about sci-fi, and curious enough, I have a seven-year-old at home, and Saturday mornings, she is really drawn to the campy 50s sci-fi, Them, It Came from Outer Space, The Monster Beneath the Sea. I mean, it's... nowadays, it looks like somebody shot it in a garage with a 150-watt light bulb, but because it's so campy. But they're just really fun movies. And as far as the economics of the film, I was wondering if you guys could speak. I'm in my 50s, and I got a couple of kids, and obviously the movie industry is not making any money off of me. I mean, the last picture I took the family to see was, I think, March of the Penguins. And I'm guessing the economics is not going to change. I mean, the audience, I'm guessing, is going to be in their teens and their 20-somethings. I mean, they're not shooting for family movies anymore, are they?
Shooting for family movies. They're not shooting as much for, aging baby boomers, excuse me, of which I am one. Aging baby boomers kept their movie-going habits, so you can get solid, if not spectacular, grosses from movies that appeal just to aging baby boomers. But the family market for, your penguin-type movies. Don't forget your animated films, the Shrek franchise and all of the Pixar movies are huge. Yeah. And so the family market, maybe tends to be animated more than not, so to speak. But they are definitely shooting for G and mild PG. That's for sure.
So that's baby boomers with kids. Is that what you're...
Younger. I mean, these baby boomers don't often, tend to have the youngsters. So it's more like, the family audience, whatever it is, people with kids. But what I'm saying about the baby boomers is you can still shoot a movie as long as the budget is $50 million or less. You might be able to shoot a film for them. But still, the demographics is 15 to 35. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the amount of money now is so fantastic that, am I right to assume, I mean, a movie almost has to hit the ground running and be a success right out of the box.
It has to hit the ground running. And the other thing that's very important to these big budget movies is the international market. You need to do anywhere from 75 to 125% of your domestic gross, you need to do overseas. So, your giant budget movies that cost $150 million to $200 million to make are going to have a problem in the U.S. Alone, but it's that overseas. So it's a combination of hitting the ground running and the international market.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to hang up, but I was wondering, with my observation with movies like Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, do you think that has any merit there? And I'll let you listen off there.
Those movies do very well on DVD. Multiple viewings are very important. I agree with you, but I think those movies do very well on DVD, and that's very important. But my point about Star Wars and the big budget sci-fi is exactly right, except for something like 2001 Space Odyssey. It was rare to have a big budget sci-fi because it's so associated with the lower budget 50s movies that now are considered camp and were at the time. These were mostly independently made, very low budget at the time, and they wanted to find a niche that the big studios were not filling, and sci-fi and horror and youth exploitation movies were the ways they went.
And were most of those movies made to be shown as weekend matinees? Did they think that mostly those would be people, say, under 20 would be going to see those movies?
Oh, yeah. And the other market that was very big for exploitation and low budget movies was the once important drive-in movies.
Ah, yes. I've read about those.
So, yeah, the thing, not only drive-in, but also in the 50s, you always had multiple features in movies. But when the main studios began to fade starting in the early 50s for various reasons, you then got your kind of low-budget double features. Mm-hmm. So you could have, low-budget creature feature, double features and things like that that you could market to inner-city theaters and drive-ins and Saturday matinees. And, you know, that's where they were.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go on here and talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. I enjoy listening to you talk. You're very interesting. I was going to say the Hollywood creative accounting sort of leaves you know, that who makes what, where, and when. I mean, it's all in some mirage. But I was going to say that on the Spielberg film, I've always really enjoyed Empire of the Sun, based on the Ballard book.
Yeah.
And it's so magical. It's Spielberg at his best. The lighting, all these just amazing scenes in this film. I mean, it captures this like time and place that is very, very interesting. And as you were saying about Lucas as a bad director, I think the only thing he ever did right was American Graffiti.
Yes.
And talk about John Sayles, you know, the independent filmmakers and stuff, but also the Colin Firth film you were talking about was really panned by Roper and the guy from The Tribune.
Oh, really? And Then She Found Me?
Yeah, they really? Have a review last Sunday night, yeah. If you can get it online if you want.
Well, the Tribune and Entertainment Weekly liked it.
Yeah, it's interesting to see their review because they go, but it's interesting to see. But I was going to ask you about, I've spoken to this before, but the amount of films seen, I mean, when I was a kid, I was born in 1950, so I saw the few Disney films. My father was in the military, so I lived all over the world, so I didn't really see a lot of films like a lot of kids my age would have seen. But I'm wondering about the cumulative amount of information that people get from film and how it enforces their almost social behavior. Sort of like when you see Spielberg's, about the Shoah and, Schindler's List, and you see how he reinforces the brutality of the Nazis and then gives you this whole enlightening story, sort of like visualizing something you read about, the Holocaust. And then another film such as, light comedy. And I'm just wondering how, if anybody's ever, I'm not sure if you're really interested in this, but if there's all these psychology studies and these social studies on the effect of film cumulative on people. And, how it's so ingrained in us. I mean, I see a lot of films on DVD, and I've seen a lot of theatrical films over my life, but I'm wondering if you know much about that, or if that's some of your concern, or wonder if it's even, how the communists used film as propaganda, that kind of thing, back when they were around, and how the Internet is used by supposedly Al-Qaeda, and visualizing the, terrorist bomber. I wonder about all this accumulative cumulative information.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I wonder if you think about this, or if it's been done in graduate papers or doctoral students. I'm just wondering if there could be a tie-in somewhere where, how this is, because, it's been around since the 30s and in large scale probably since the 40s and 50s, and how the Western is embedded in certain people's psychology. And I'm just wondering if you'd speak about that. I really enjoy your stints on this show, and I think you're a really bright man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have no idea. No. In the 30s, there were studies, movies' effects on children and the sociology of movies and things like that. There are different studies that come out. People, of course, believe that movies have an effect, and that's why you have both liberal and conservative activist groups. More than that, you have, I think, activist groups for television, because television is so much more ubiquitous and people just watch, kids especially, watch so much television. It's incredible. I'm not a sort of content analysis and effects kind of guy. I'm sure there are doctoral dissertations and things like that. But the question of cumulative effects, that is to say, how many movies you watched from the time you were a kid for your behavior now, I don't think has been done, because the question is, for scientific experiments, you'd need control groups. And so you'd have to find a large number of people who rarely, if ever, went to the movies, who rarely, if ever, watched TV. What are you looking for? Now, certainly people have studied, you put a group of kids, especially boys, show them a violent or a hyped up TV show, in a controlled environment. And then what will they do immediately after? There's no question that will have immediate effects in terms of how they play with dolls, how they play with other kids. Will they sit still, etc.? but, you know, follow those same kids into their 30s, 40s, and 50s. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of that. So the answer is people believe in the educational and propaganda possibilities for movies. They believe in the negative effects of movies and television shows. I always say that people believe in the negative effects of TV and movies, but do they ever judge the positive effects? If you watched hundreds and hundreds of humanistic art films, would you be a better person? Or are you the kind of person already who wants to see those kind of movies? And so you're, you know, so the answer is I'm not aware of any long-term studies of the cumulative effects of media on people. But, you know, certainly people do believe that. And of course, now the question becomes video games. I mean, why are there ratings? Why are there ratings on video games? So intuitively, inductively, in certain studies, you know, we'll say that these things are, especially violence, is desensitizing, dehumanizing. Studies about pornography, also, you know, images of women and unrealistic things. So people believe that there are effects. Whether or not we can actually study them, I haven't heard of a kind of long term, like in medicine, right? You have a study of, you know, people over 20 years taking this diet or these pills. But for media, it's much more difficult, I think, to do cumulative. So people go with, you know, violence is bad for, you know, too much violence is going to be bad for kids. But, you know, kids who are exposed to a lot of that in the 60s, are they very violent now in the 2000s? I don't know.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies. He's also director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at University of Illinois. And occasionally he's here and we talk about movies. Questions are welcome. We have a caller who has been patient. We'll get right to 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. A toll-free 800-222-9455. Line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. There's a movie that I'm curious about that really no one has ever heard of it. And I heard of it by word of mouth. And my wife and I rented the movie and looked at it. And it was one of the most entertaining movies I've ever seen. And everybody I know who's seen it agree with me. The name of the movie was Secondhand Lions. And it starred...
Duvall?
Yeah.
And Michael Caine.
Michael Caine, right. Yeah. And the I think the problem with the movie was that it painted the Middle East culture in a very positive light toward the end of the movie, and that was released right after 9/11. And I've often wondered if that's not the reason why it was never hyped at all. It was never talked about, and no one ever heard of it, you know. I think you're probably familiar with the movie.
Yeah, that, you know, it's a small film. you may be right about it's, I mean, some movies, you know, we talked earlier about how you want to hit the ground running and what's that first weekend, because the big blockbuster is doing very well if the second weekend grosses will be 50% of the previous weekend, which seems like a big fall off, but people are very happy if it's only 50%. Some movies require the word of mouth where, you know, it does X number of dollars the first week. The second week it's doing just about the same or better. So word of mouth can be very important. So something like Secondhand Lions is a film that's A, hard to market, I think. B, it's a smaller film. The Duvall and Michael Caine are very big stars, but they're not the kind of stars that are going to appeal to the primary demographic, right? It's the kind of movie that probably will do just as well on DVD as it did in theaters. But you may be right that word of mouth didn't build. Because of its post 9/11, as it were, not that it's a post 9/11 subject matter, but as you say, it got caught up in post 9/11. But there are a lot of reasons why a small film doesn't do as well. You're also talking about the fall, where, you know, I mean, it's the kind of movie where you might be thinking Oscar nominations to help its box office or its DVD down the road. But for small films to find an audience. There can be any number of reasons why it doesn't do as well. But if, you know, you say you really liked it and everyone else liked it, then obviously it'll have a life on DVD.
Well, okay. Thanks for the suggestion. So if people are interested in watching a movie, go on down to wherever you rent your movies.
I think that came up in a previous show. So obviously, really? I think people really do like secondhand lines.
Well,
I think it's time to acclaim that film as the sleeper hit of the last decade.
Also, Haley Joel Osment and Kira Sedgwick
it was a film in which Haley Joel Osment needs to learn lessons from these older guys. But also Haley Joel, kind of living off the success only of one film. I remember when it came out and I remember thinking this is going to be a tough sell because it's, a film about a youngster who is going to learn lessons from these oldsters. Could be the kind of movie that, is a Hallmark Hall of Fame type thing, has an older type audience, or as I say, we'll find a second life on DVD, but it's a tough sell in theaters.
All right. Well, if folks want to call in and talk about movies or tell us about some that they've seen, maybe you'd like to recommend something that you've seen recently you thought was particularly good, or you can also call in and say, look, I saw this movie and it was terrible. Stay away from it. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was thinking about the question that the earlier caller raised and thinking back to the time before television where I expect that there were probably a lot of people who, to the extent that they had the means, went to the movies every week.
Yes.
And I wonder whether, given that, today there is so much exposure to images and the movies are available on television and for rental, do you think now that your average person in his or her lifetime sees more movies than, say, our grandparents saw in their entire lifetime?
No. The people who, the average American went to the movies weekly before World War II and during World War II, though the average American had changed in terms of being mostly women. But the demographics of movie going were far different than they are now, and they went to the local theater regularly. Now what happens is because of the marketing of movies or the kind of movies that are made, the average American doesn't see so many movies. It's that smaller demographic is what sees a lot of movies. And so you can't really beat once weekly. The average American, used to go to the movies maybe 10, 15 years ago once yearly. Now it's become four times yearly. So it's your regular moviegoers who are going once weekly that are keeping movies, and then the kind of, the movies on DVD. So the answer is people can see movies more regularly, but compared to the olden days, they aren't seeing more than they used to.
Mm.
Part of it, of course, also has to do with leisure time choices. The average American watches a lot of TV. Now, whether they're watching network TV is another story, but TV is very, very crucial, especially to older Americans who watch a lot of the television. That's why the networks are in trouble, is their demographic isn't as desirable. Right? People over 50 watch an enormous amount of TV, but they're not the people that the networks want to get.
Yeah.
Right? People, I watch American Idol and I keep thinking, why are they choosing the wrong people? They're choosing the wrong people because these are all teenagers who don't know anything. Don't know what's good singing, so my vote doesn't matter as much as the demographic of American Idol.
All right, let's talk with someone in Philo, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, I just, you may have maybe mentioned this movie already. It was Delirious. It was at the Ebert Fest.
No, it hasn't come up today.
Okay, I have teenagers, so young teenagers, and of course they want to go to the movie once a week, and I go maybe once a year.
Uh-huh.
And they really, they like the movies that I don't really want to go see. But I took my son to the Ebert one, The Delirious. Now, it has a lot of cussing in it, but, beyond that, it was he liked it for the different reasons than I did, but I want to get that on DVD. It was hysterical. I just loved it. And I think it hit some good points, and just really liked it as an older family movie, something that maybe teens and adults would enjoy.
Oh, is it available on DVD yet?
I
don't know. I know he had a hard time. The director talked about how some nightmares he had with he couldn't distribute it.
Well, I'm looking here at the Internet Movie Database trying to answer, in fact, that question.
Well, there'll be a little sign on DVD that you can collect.
Okay.
you think it's not? Huh?
No, it's not.
No, it's not, says David Esser. No, it's not. Oh, that's interesting. So, and this this has now been out for a couple of years.
Yeah, and it has... You know, the Fargo star, I keep forgetting his name, but...
Steve Buscemi.
The funny-looking guy.
Yeah, these small films, you know, the distribution these days for small films, very, very hard.
Yeah.
And then what has to happen is that a small DVD distributor has to get it. So it's a kind of double whammy. Without theatrical distribution to speak of, it's a DVD sale. I mean, there's a paradox. And that is, although DVD has made a lot more movies available than ever before, you know, in the days of even you know, in the 70s and 80s, but they're still the same. There's still that same drive, and that is the biggest movies will still be the most commonly and easily available on DVD, and you'll have to work harder to get the smaller movies, and they do need to have some kind of distributor.
And it had, you know, the beautiful young stars in it as well as the older ones. I mean, that they weren't famous, but I thought it would really appeal, and I was right. I mean, I think it would appeal to teenagers because of the young man in the film, and then that pop star that was kind of a Miley Cyrus. I don't know. She was just kind of a mixture of a lot of different pop stars. Too bad. I think it could have been marketed, but maybe it just didn't have the right names.
Well, it's a combination. I mean, the place where small movies need to make their mark is a Sundance Festival. And sometimes a lot of movies that do well at Sundance, you know, audience favorite, that don't get picked up. I mean, it's really a matter of smaller distributors come and go these days. It's a very tough business. Then it's a matter of, does someone think they can market it enough? But it's, you know, it's very, very tough. And then, you know, again, a small DVD. I think that's a movie that'll show up on DVD eventually.
I was going to ask
it's
you,
rare,
that would be
yeah.
nice to see. So even though it doesn't come out right away, somebody eventually...
I think so. I think so.
Somebody can pick it up and make it into a DVD?
I think so. I'd be surprised.
Is it enough people ask for it, or just how does that work?
Well, it would be difficult to know who to ask.
Yeah.
It'll just be a matter of... I mean, it may not come out, but most movies do. You know,
okay. So okay. It's
just a matter of following the DVD releases.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, thank you. And I would think that it would cost so little to do it that you'd think if I could make some money putting this out on DVD, I would. If you were some distributor, would think, well, if I can make some money doing this, I should do it.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, you know, do they think they can make any money? And now, if as long as the movie's been made in the last few years, it won't be a problem to find somebody to distribute. What happens with older movies is very interesting. A lot of the low-budget movies, the rights to release these things would be in question.
Mm-hmm.
So the company that I find most interesting is 20th Century Fox. They have a lot of good movies that they don't have out on DVD. And either they hold them back to, you know, periodically to inject a little cash flow, or the way that they were marketed or distributed in the first place, the rights to, you know, subsequent, you know, in the old days, we had movies only, and the ancillary markets were non-existent. Then when television came in, you had like, okay, we have the rights now to distribute them in theaters, to distribute them non-theatrically, on airplanes, in schools, and on television. Then, you know, you had pay TV. So now do we have the rights to distribute on pay TV? Then VHS. So now what they do is, you know, we have the rights to distribute these things in any format that we can think of. Including satellites, including beaming them to Mars, the Saturn distribution network, whatever it is, right? So it's like all formats. And that's why, of course, you had the strike which was you suddenly had a new right on the internet. Even though no one has made any money on internet distribution, somebody will.
Yeah.
So somebody wants a piece of that. So you really need to write these things like that. So, you know, but of course, I don't know. I thought about getting into the distribution business years and years ago because I found a great film that no one sort of knew about. And I thought, well, maybe I'll distribute it. It's a bad idea. I didn't get into the business, but it's a very, very tough business. And now with, you know, what are the DVD companies? But you know who does their best job of finding interesting movies that they think can be sold to a niche market? Curiously enough, is Criterion.
Oh, uh-huh.
So, you know, Criterion releases older movies, foreign movies, but also some niche movies. And so you may, you know, in a year or two see this movie on Criterion, which would be great because they do the best job of visual and extras.
Well, I will thank the caller. It should be really interesting to see in the future with the proliferation of platforms, of various kinds of screens, little screens, big screens, ones you can put in your pocket, ones that you nail to the wall, various ways of watching media, what that's going to mean for availability of a wide range of content, and whether that's just going to mean that you're going to have 1,000 ways to watch the same junk, or whether that that there will be an opening up of that there will be so many niches and that the cost of distribution will be low if you can someone can download something, you know, if you got enough broadband so that you can say, okay, you just go to my website and you click on this and you can download it and I'll charge your credit card $9.95, that might actually mean that more material would be available, or, you know, will that just mean that everybody's going to be watching Lost and Desperate Housewives and downloading Iron Man and Spider-Man 12?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. The real issue will be, I mean, someone like Steven Soderbergh is very interested in, you know, made, and there's a movement to made for downloading, so to speak. You need to keep your costs down, which of course you can. You don't shoot on film, you shoot on video. But that's the question. The question is how much money can you make and how you're going to make it. And so what you see is the model, of course, of music. Is when they realized that they could bypass, as it were, CDs, there's some money to be made. But the costs, even in movies, are so much great. So if you can find a way to charge people, you will be able to find, certainly there already is a proliferation of content, and that's YouTube. There's so much stuff available, but most of that stuff on YouTube is already extant, and they find weird things, or they make it for YouTube, but they're not making any money. So the question is, can you market a movie and make sufficient funds at the same time? And the key will really be to get to, you know, without the distribution marketing aspect of movies, where are you going to advertise? How are you going to get people to know about your product? That seems to me to be the key. But there's no question that the various screens and downloads and broadband and all that stuff will have more content available and will eventually, you know, become a much bigger business than it is. There's no question about that.
All right. Let's talk with some more folks here. Charleston next, line 4. Hello.
Hi, I tuned in late, so I don't know if you've already talked about The Painted Veil.
Nope.
It's a wonderful movie that I'd like to recommend, and Ed Norton and Naomi Watts produced it and starred in it. And I first read about it in Budget Travel Magazine, because the magazine regularly features articles on traveling to locations where movies were filmed. And The Painted Veil was filmed in a beautiful part of China, and it's based on the Somerset Maugham novel. And it's wonderful. I've seen it 3 times.
On DVD?
On DVD.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was a theatrical flop, and the reviews, as I recall, were less... Yeah, right, so-so. So it's one of these star-driven movies. I remember the other star is Liev Schreiber, who's now married to Naomi Watts. It's a nice film. I agree, but I think that it's a very specialized. It's a kind of, intense drama. On the other hand, sort of low key, but I'm glad you liked it as well. I happen to like it too.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, I saw it also. My wife and I saw it on DVD. Yeah, in fact, we did. And thought that it was a very good movie. So no, you shouldn't feel bad about liking it or recommending it. I thought that it was a very good movie. And it was, I think, obviously the place where it was shot, it really had a stunning, lent a stunning background and a feel to the
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, it was very nice. Have, I mean, you go back to the 50s, especially after the Communist Revolution, there was a number of films about China and shot nowhere near. So it really does make a difference to have China opened up. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Chinese cinema is that not only have they done a lot of co-productions, but they've really been interested in having their space used as locations.
Well, thank you. Yes, Painted Veil. All right. Let's. Now someone called in, heard our conversation earlier about Delirious, and said, yes, it is available on DVD.
Oh, really? Okay.
So you can.
Can I take a peek at your screen?
Yeah, okay. Here's the Internet Movie Database. Is it somewhere here on it? It says whether it does or.
Yeah.
Not there. Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's not clickable. So what that means is that Amazon doesn't have it. And that's what I was looking at. If there's no DVD to, you know, there's a thing on the Internet Movie Database is owned by Amazon, so that you hook in. So if the DVD icon is clickable, that means it's available from Amazon. If not,
I beg to differ, sir. Oh. Here it looks like it right there. Yeah, that's it.
All right.
Yes, in
so
fact,
what
Amazon
company has it then?
Selling it for
$12.99.
For $12.99. Yeah, let's see, who is it? Studio Genius Products is the studio.
That's what I said. Some small thing will happen. I wonder why the Amazon doesn't the icon doesn't click. That's interesting.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that's
anyway
good to know. There we go.
If you're interested
available.
In seeing the movie, it is available. Okay, yeah. Very good. If you didn't get a chance to see it at the festival, let us talk next with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hello, another recommendation for you. I know this, when I heard about it being reviewed by Roper and friends, I looked at it and they kind of panned it, but I don't agree with them. World's Fastest Indian.
Oh.
And it's an Anthony Hopkins film. It's made by a guy from down New Zealand way. Speaking of interesting company names, one of the companies that helps produce it is Three Dogs and a Pony, which I love the name of. But it's Anthony Hopkins, and he does just a real great job of portraying a guy who at age 65 decides he's going to go all the way around the world to see if he can run his modified 1923 Indian motorcycle on the salt flats. And he goes there, and he actually does it. And not only that, but he came back about 6 or 7 times and set some speed records that are still living. But the thing's nice about it is that it is about a guy who's 65 years old and decides he's going to follow his dream, and he does it. And even though he's got all sorts of physical and physical problems, like he's got angina or something like that, real heart problems, has to take nitroglycerin all the time, he still does it, and he also wins the affections of all the people that he meets at the salt flats. And I got a chance to see the motorcycle, if I didn't even get to see the guy, because he died in early 70s or so. But it's really an engineering feat and a very interesting film. Anthony Hopkins, on several interview shows, said he thought it was one of the better films that he had done in a long time, and he was really tired of the Hannibal Lecter type films that he was doing. And then I noticed about a year and a half later, he was doing a couple more films very similar to that.
Well, you got to pay the bills.
You got to pay the bills. Yeah. No, I hadn't seen that. I remember when it came out. I bet that the two things that worked against that movie, but the thing I bet most is the title.
Yeah, I think so. But the thing was, is it's also kind of a gearhead picture, and I think a lot of people really aren't into that, but then it's also low budget.
Right, and it's kind of foreign, I mean, the down under.
But then the other thing is that I've noticed in a lot of motorcycle magazines, including an antique motorcycle magazine that I'm a member of an antique motorcycle club, that it's continuing to be advertised. So they're really pushing it, and they're definitely pushing it to the motorcycle.
Yeah, that's your motorcycle
crowd. Your niche audience right there.
But yeah. I would say that anybody who has a desire to not give up living, not turn old and decrepit like the stereotype is. This is a film that it's for him, because this guy comes to America in the 60s, and he's from a very small town, and he goes right into Los Angeles. And it's just a mind blower to him. And one of the first persons he meets is a transvestite hotel clerk. And that just kind of throws him off. But then it's kind of an interesting little journey across America in the 60s. And it's a very nice picture about somebody who just doesn't want to give up living.
Great. All right.
So, and I went out and I bought like 3 copies of it and been giving it away to friends and
well, that helps.
Family members, too.
That helps.
All right. So
well,
thank you much.
Thank you.
I enjoy
thanks
this sort
suggestion.
Of film show because it's it fills me in on a lot of stuff and gives me a little bit of highlights on things I don't haven't seen. I also recommend Ang Lee's Pushing Hands as
oh,
well.
Very nice film.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Now you're getting into Dave's one of his specialty
yeah.
areas, Asian cinema.
Yeah. No, I definitely like Pushing Hands as well.
All right. Well, I think we're at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I'm sorry we have a caller that we can't take. My apologies. But I want to say thanks to the callers. I appreciate the recommendations for the films. Anything you want to mention as a DVD pick you would suggest to people?
I suggest 2 things real quick. The Bob Dylan crazy biopic by Todd Haynes called I'm Not There, with 6 people playing Bob Dylan, including one of them, the late Heath Ledger. The other is the for fans of the classic westerns of the 1950s. The great Anthony Mann teamed with Gary Cooper for what's called a late western, you know, the sort of decline of the West, the decline of the western with Gary Cooper, called Man of the West. That's a really good western drama. I hadn't seen it in a few years, and one of my favorites.
All right, very good. Thanks very much for being here.
My
pleasure. Appreciate it. Dave Defler, he's professor of cinema studies and director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at University of Illinois. Every once in a while, you see it, we talk about the movies.